Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome back to Beyond Brunel. In this episode, we're talking about inclusive design. How do we make our communities safe, usable, and enjoyable for all, regardless of age, ability, and circumstances? Joining me in the studio is Steve Maslin, an associate and technical authority for inclusive design at Atkins Realis. And online is Pam Turton, Head of Transport Strategy in Sustainable Communities with Bath and North East Somerset Council. Welcome, Steve. Welcome, Pam. I'm really interested in just starting with a question. What's the difference between inclusivity and accessibility? So, Steve, can you start us off?
It's the breadth and the narrowness of the two different words in people's perception. So, traditionally, accessibility has been associated with a particular group of people who would otherwise face barriers and exclusions, whereas inclusive design is essentially designing for everybody. Sometimes it's synonymous with another term called universal design, essentially means the same thing, designing for everybody. So you're taking account of, as part of that, people's accessibility needs and requirements and seeking to remove barriers as part of that process. But you're not necessarily focusing solely on one particular group. I mean, not solely trust taking a special approach. You're taking an approach that's excellent in its entirety for everybody. In practice, though, you having to pay attention to accessibility considerations as part of inclusion, because in the main, those experiences of facing barriers are what enables us to identify the issues that we need to address.
And Pam, when we're designing our infrastructure, I wonder, are there any core principles which you live by?
The number one core principle has to be engaging with our communities across the entire cohort of our communities to make sure that we are hearing from all voices, and particularly making that extra effort to hear voices which perhaps don't or aren't usually represented within consultations. I think co-design has become quite a popular way of doing scheme design in recent years, and it is essentially aiming to bring people together who have lived experience of the area, together with people who have expertise in design, to understand better what the particular issues are of a community and work with the community to come up with solutions for that area, which the community feel will benefit them and their neighbours. And that does definitely mean changing how we do things. And it does mean that we have to seek out new ways and different ways of engaging with our communities to make sure that we have that understanding that we are designing with as opposed to designing for. And through that, we will be able to create from the outset inclusive design rather than retrofitting after the fact.
So I guess on that basis, it really is about end users and getting their feedback, engaging them at an early stage. We know that co-design is so important. We've spoken about that on Beyond Brunel before. Steve, should we be doing more to engage those people? And is it not something that we've known about for a while?
I think we need to make sure we're considering engagement at all times. But I think we also need to be aware that there's only so much you can do in terms of engagement. People can experience engagement fatigue, where they're constantly being asked very similar questions about very similar schemes. And therefore, I think one of the things I would advocate is getting review of designs by people who are specialists in the field, such as members of the National Register of Access Consultants, who can evaluate schemes and guide teams prior to presenting their schemes to stakeholder groups. It doesn't bode well when, say, access groups receive designs or present designs what to them are obvious mistakes. Therefore, it's worth approaching that engagement, being well prepared and knowing the subject realm and the issues that you want to discuss well prior to the process of engagement.
Steve's exactly right. It's a combination, isn't it, of us reviewing and checking in terms that we've done absolutely everything we can, but simultaneously really being with the community in terms of understanding what their issues are with infrastructure, why it doesn't work, what needs to be changed, what different types of things they want to see. And I think that prioritisation of being in the community and being in that space is really vital to make sure that we are actually going out and seeing those places, cycling them, walking them, taking public transport in those areas to really begin to understand. So when people are talking about that bench over there by the corner, we can relate to that and we understand what they're talking about.
So really, really key to engage with those stakeholders, those individuals early on from a diverse range of backgrounds. Yeah. But Pam, is it not the case that we also need to gain feedback post-implementation of this infrastructure, see what's really working and what's not? I'd ask, you know, are we doing that enough?
In terms of going back and checking, absolutely. It's such a fundamental part of what we're doing. We need to understand how people feel about the changes that have been implemented and whether or not they're actually doing what we initially thought they would. In terms of whether or not we are doing that enough, I would suggest not. I think there tends to be a very heavy focus on delivery, 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 and doing the kind of first bits that will get us to that point. And then the going back and the checking and the review and feeding that back in to how we can improve we do things next time is often further down the priority listing. And I don't think it necessarily gets the emphasis that I think it probably should. I think it's a really important part, particularly if we are going down a route of being much more engaged with the community. We need to do the other half of that. We need to balance it off, because asking communities, which is Steve's point really about this consultation fatigue, you know, we're asking people to give up their time to come and engage with us, walk routes, speak to us, be involved. And I really feel it's incumbent upon us to complete that circle. You know, we can't just deliver something and then never see the community again. I think we've started an expectation of engagement that we are on a bound to continue. And then we can show that we're responding. If things aren't working quite as we'd all hope they would, then we can look at how we can improve things. But that relationship between the delivery agent and the community, I think, has to be enduring and must have that final link.
So really, it's a case of closing that feedback loop and making sure that we do get that complete picture.
Yeah, I would say so.
Now, I just want to turn to a definition which is provided by the Sensory Trust. They say inclusive design makes places usable by everyone, regardless of age, ability and circumstance. But can we really be inclusive for everyone, Steve?
You're always going to find situations where people find barriers and challenges in a given situation. But I work on the basis that one seeks to enable and remove the barriers and the challenges that people like to encounter. Some people will be keen to use the word, we will ensure. And I go, you're likely to find that somebody will find some challenge with something. What you need to set out with is the word enable. The design or the proposals are seeking to enable and prepare the way for as many possibilities for the individuals that may encounter your design. And it's a direction and an intent that you should be sort of aiming on. And just to kind of make reference to some guiding principles in my mind, is you're seeking to achieve a positive user experience. In order to achieve that, focus on a service outcome. Yes, we design products, but they should be serving a purpose as opposed to being a product in their own right that doesn't deliver a service or doesn't enable a positive user experience. It's having the right mindset and keeping constantly aware of the barriers that people can encounter. Those can be many and varied. I would probably make an observation, an area I have particularly interested in is to do with the realm of neurodiversity, the realm of the mind. Only in the last 15 years has there been growing understanding of how environments and designs and schemes and proposals can have an impact on people's minds. That's just one example. I could go on.
No, that's a great snapshot, Steve. And so the message I'm getting is all about co-design. It's about a service and the user experience and intention rather than execution, on the basis that we might not always get the execution right, but as long as the will and the intention is there, we can work with people to develop a better design and a better infrastructure.
We should always aim to get it right and make every effort to get it right. And there's many reasons why we can do better than can be the case at the moment, where people won't necessarily execute things based on embodied knowledge. We need to always be striving for the best we can, but always at the same time being keeping that learning loop going and that conversation with the communities and the people we serve.
We'll come back to neurodiversity because I know that it's a really hot topic at the minute and is obviously something you're interested in, Steve. But just taking a step back, I suppose, in terms of infrastructure and the sectors that we tend to deal with, I guess a really obvious one in which we can design inclusively is probably property, but also transport. And I know transport is one of your key focus areas, Pam. So how should the Southwest be planning for a more inclusive transport system?
there's possibly a reframing that we need to do as an industry, that we shouldn't be looking at the infrastructure in isolation. So we shouldn't be looking purely at whether we have an accessible bus or we have an accessible timetable. I think we need to be understanding the degree to which we are actually designing inclusive journeys from the point of departure from somebody's front door to the point of reaching their total destination, their absolute destination, as opposed to, you know, 400 meters from their destination, that all of that is inclusive as possible. And I think for me that there's a real need to change how we think about the different aspects of the transport system and how they integrate together. So, for example, we tend to be quite split in our focus, that we tend to either focus on infrastructure through capital spend, and then the revenue spend aspects are over here somewhere. And really, I think we need a much stronger focus on bringing those two revenue streams together. And I think that will enable the points that Steve was making earlier about this kind of user experience. So in terms of what I feel would be beneficial for our communities within the Southwest, is really looking at it from that total journey perspective to understand how people are seeing the data, whether it's effective, it's available in a form that people can understand, be that digital, be that paper timetables, however people are accessing it, they should feel confident in being able to understand the information that's presented to them, know where to get it, and then be able to make every step of that journey in a way that is recognizing and responsive to their particular needs. That's the big thing for focus.
So one of the things I use in a memoir from my colleagues is something we call the envelope of need. And I use a hand to express this because there are 5 points on it. I encourage people to think about mobility, visual, auditory, neurological, and metabolic needs. And then on the other hand, I ask people to think about, in terms of design proposals, is the logistics, and by that I mean people's personal journey planning, legibility, clarity, ergonomics, which is sort of physical interaction, reach, and things like that, and psychology. You've got those two hands in play and you're thinking about the issues. You then start to discover issues like, for example, on a journey, a typical question that people will have in a particularly long journey or a journey that consists of various parts. They'll be considering key questions like, when I get to here, are there going to be facilities for me, such as toilets? And the amount of people that will not embark on transport journeys that we would encourage them to take, but don't do it because of the lack of appropriate facilities en route, I suggest is quite a significant one. So older people, parents with young children, always going to be thinking about that crucial thing. Mm. Another aspect of that sort of journey sequence would be the very planning stage and getting a ticket. And at the moment, for understandable reasons, there's a lot of focus on digital technology, which has a lot of enabling capabilities in it. But for some, it just doesn't work. I know from my own family experience, there are people who will struggle to engage with our transport systems because of reliance on getting digital forms of ticketing. So those are all things I think we need to sort of be really cognizant. And they're sometimes seen as the nice to haves. And for many people, they're actually quite essential. And I think the more we give those sort of considerations thought, I think we'll get a better outcome for everybody.
I'm going to be wandering around town with my hands now, trying to remember those different principles and, and spotting different bits.
Steve raised a really great point about that. And I think a lot of it relates to confidence in the transport network and having that confidence that there will be those facilities and the kind of confidence of the what if question in terms of, you know, what if I miss my connection? What will then happen? Will I be able to replan? Will I be able to rethink about it? And I think that links also to this increasing dominance of digital information. We've been doing some research recently that's been looking at access versus confidence. And while, you know, in the cohort we were looking at, it was about 2/3 of people had access to a smartphone, but only 1/3 of people were actually confident in using it. And I think that really does hit home in terms of yet another layer that is making our systems perhaps not as inclusive as they should be in terms of people feeling empowered or enabled to use the systems that are there.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn.
Steve, you spoke about several different points there, which I just want to pick up on. There was neurodivergence, There was psychology and metabolics. I wonder, is there more emphasis being placed on those different parts of your model now?
In the realm of neurodiversity, yes. And it's something I've been participating in, particularly writing and speaking on the subject. It takes us back 15 years ago. The guidance that was available said very little about people's neurological needs, partly because they were seen as intangible. When you take account of the significance that environment has on how people's brains function and look into the subject, you find it's extremely tangible because the sensory environment around us has to be processed. And our brains vary in the way that we process information to the extent that if we don't have any sensory input whatsoever, our brains will struggle significantly to function indeed. There's an example of somebody who tried to stand out a period of time in an acoustically dead space with the light switched off. And within about half an hour, they started to lose their balance and started to hallucinate. So when you start to put in to a design environment things that could give rise to sensory stimulus, you have to also think about the potential for positive outcomes, but also problematic outcomes. Say in the urban realm, taking account of the surface people walk across is quite key in that regard. The level of sensory stimulus that was giving to people and the confusion that can come as a result of someone's well-intentioned design to create something stunning, but on the other hand, can act as a challenge and a barrier to individuals because it's giving them all the wrong sensory stimuli.
And Pam, I guess on that basis then, I suppose some of the things that Steve's alluding to is these interfaces, public interfaces between different modes of transport, between spaces, the feeling, the noise. I guess there's quite a lot of competing requirements here. And so it feels like a real challenge to try and consider each of those different aspects for each of those different individuals that we might be talking about today. I wonder, in terms of a local authority, are you scared of getting it wrong?
There's such a strong desire to be improving things. And I think for local authorities and for people who have gone in to work in local authorities, I think that that is the overwhelming desire to actually be making things better. I think it is absolutely challenging when you're looking at all of the different interactions and all of the different ways in which we can actually have a positive impact or not. I think it is enormously challenging to do that, especially when you're looking at something like the transport system. And I think Steve's earlier point about, you know, looking at it as a system is absolutely right. And making sure that all of those aspects are working together in coordination is incredibly challenging. But I think knowledge and curiosity are kind of everything in that. You know, that if understanding impact and understanding the diversity of impact is a critical first step to actually enable us to start to do things differently and be better in terms of how we are achieving our aims around transport and inclusivity.
And Steve, I'm going to ask you a very simple question. Integration or segregation?
Integration. Segregation is disabling to everybody to the extent, if we particularly in an education context, many people develop what I call awareness impairment and are disabled by the lack of meeting, being educated with peers that are different to themselves. The more integration we have, the more enabling and less disabling it is.
And Pam, off the back of that then, I suppose, another very simple question, equality or equity, which should we strive for?
Equity. I think it recognises the difference. You know, there's that kind of picture that I think everyone's probably seen about the football game on the wall and what they mean in terms of the difference of equality, giving everyone the same size of block to sit on, and equity, making sure that the child who's in that group of three has a taller block so they can actually see over the wall and see the football game. I mean, I think that should be what we're striving for. It's equity of access, equity of opportunity, isn't it, that we need to get? And that will mean different things for different groups and will mean different things in different contexts. So for me, that's what we should be striving for.
You must have seen my notes, Pam, because that's exactly the picture I've got in front of me. We've spoken about inclusive design quite broadly, and I wonder, we've spoken about it from a conceptual point of view and looking at this bigger picture. Do we as engineers, as architects, as infrastructure professionals get too hung up on the details more often than not? Is it not a case of taking a step back, Steve, and really trying to incorporate this system of systems thinking that you were discussing earlier?
system thinking or broader aims and concepts are key, and there can be a tendency for people to not see the wood for the trees and focus on the details at the expense of seeing the wider picture. But I would be reluctant to say that the details are not important. In many a case, the finest of details can have the most significant impacts on people's lives as a barrier. In the course of my life, I've done care activity, care work, and I know that you can get the slightest thing wrong or not pay a particular attention to a particular aspect of someone's need, and it can have quite significant ramifications. That's in a care context. And take an individual that's facing barriers and difficulties in their life, and they're into a situation where they're trying to gain access. I even know, for example, somebody probably doesn't fly anymore because of the experience they had. Then they got back from their holiday, met with the scene of their powered wheelchair, looked like it'd been through a road traffic accident, and it had fallen off the conveyor belt out of the aircraft. And the little detail of making sure that piece of equipment was handled with care was missing. Will my friend go on a flight again? I think they would think a lot more because of all the ramifications, because that was a key essential mobility aid they were without when they returned. That's why I encourage people to keep an eye on the bigger picture and the details, because you get them wrong. And I'm afraid what happens as well is long in the past, when people have invested the capital and left the project, people can be living for years with the mistakes that people make, and that as a result of not paying attention to the detail.
And we've heard, haven't we, instances of lots of different people in the media being left on flights, or, you know, not having the means to get off an aircraft, as you say, or on a train and so on. But you're right, of course. I mean, money, it all boils down to money in terms of implementing that infrastructure more often than not. We know that we have these different funding cycles for different parts of our infrastructure systems. I guess, Pam, you know, given that we are living in a cost of living crisis, is inclusive design likely to become more of a nice to have rather than a necessity?
I would certainly hope not. It's more important than ever to make sure that we are really embedding principles of inclusive design from the outset. And that has to be the foundation stone for any new development. I think that it can't be seen as a nice to have. It absolutely isn't. It's a fundamental, and it's exactly what we should be doing in terms of better providing for our communities. I think it's absolutely critical. And so, no, I don't think it's going to move to be seen as a nice to have. And in my view, it certainly shouldn't be.
And Pam, I'm going to come straight back at you. Is the creativity of infrastructure professionals curbed when we're thinking about inclusivity, or should we see it as an opportunity?
I think it's a huge opportunity, and I think it needs to be. I think it's an opportunity for our experts to really be creative in terms of how they are designing things differently and designing things in a better way. I think they should see it as a way of really starting again, you know, in terms of conventional wisdoms, in terms of how we've approached things in the past. I think there's no need for our spaces and our systems to be exclusive. And I think that, not being a designer myself, I would imagine our experts would be delighted at the opportunity to embrace the potential.
Now, I want to focus on some success stories and success stories in the Southwest. Is there a really good example of inclusive design that you could tell us about?
I was approached nearly five years ago to actually, was that the beginning of COVID, I remember, because there's certain things we had to learn to do different things differently at that point of time. So I remember it quite well. We were asked a question around provision. So the city of Bath has now got some anti-terrorist measures being put in to prevent what's called hostile vehicles entering into the parts of the city centre. And the question was put to us about accessibility. I'm pleased to say that Bath and North East Somerset took us advice as a result of a consultation we undertook and an engagement we undertook with stakeholders to come up with a scheme that enabled blue badge holders to enter the security cordon. The ramifications of that will be long lasting and the positive outcomes. And there are indications that people in other cities have noticed, and changes are afoot in other places as a result of the work that's been done in Bath. Not considered necessarily inclusive design in the conventional sense, because it's more about procedures and processes. And you have to look at how you deliver it in terms of the details. And that could be described as design. But in terms of its impact on people's everyday lives, I would hope it's really significant.
And it's that impact which is so important, isn't it? And I guess now that can be used as a blueprint for different schemes. Yeah. It sounds like it is being looked at. So, yeah, hugely positive for Bath. Pam, have you got an example?
Yeah, I do, actually. And it's a slightly different example in the sense that it's about engagement. And I would use the example of the Citizens' Jury and Citizens' Assembly that we undertook in Bath and North East Somerset a couple of years ago. And that was our first approach around kind of engagement and democracy in action, if you like. I think the reason why that was important from an inclusive perspective, A, it was designed to be fully representative of the population within Baines to make sure that we had every section of our population represented within the panel. It reimbursed people for their time, which was the point that we were discussing about earlier in terms of this consultation fatigue and kind of requiring people to give up their time in order to participate in a consultation event. And so this was kind of recognising that and recognising the burden that puts on people and addressed that by compensating people for their time. People were able to engage with it in very different ways. We had a lot of emphasis on opening up access. If people wanted face-to-face meetings or they didn't want face-to-face meetings, we were able to accommodate that. The citizens panel was basically being asked to look at how we can design our active travel infrastructure more effectively. And I think that starting the project from that premise of saying we want our community to be represented across the board and to make sure that we are doing that in an inclusive way and we are reimbursing people for their time, I think set the tone for what was a very interesting exploration of infrastructure and how we can improve it going forward.
Steve, a final question. Is there a particular community who are yet to benefit, do you feel, from inclusive design?
So, for example, we've just mentioned neurodiversity. That's the thinking and knowledge is still coming on stream. I think I'm particularly conscious of something that people don't often recognise as an access need, and that's a presence of simple things like toilets in public realms and spaces. Some people might smile because the nature of the subject is not the most glorious of subjects, but it's really essential. The more people consider it as an essential part of our infrastructure and what enables people, the better. And I think that tends to get overlooked in terms of the whole, particularly in transportation, realm of journey planning.
Pam spoke a little bit about transport there, but actually taking this more holistic view, do you think the way in which we're set up as consultants, as clients, different agencies, is that helping or hindering this approach? If I look at consultancies, typically you'll have a highways team, you'll have a perhaps an inclusive design team. These different teams for all of these different areas of infrastructure, is that helping or hindering?
Well, you inevitably need centres of excellence and capability. The key thing is that the different elements are brought together and that you have the right people in a team. Yes, that's an inevitable challenge of any organisational structure. But the key thing is to always ask the question, is there a perspective that we need at the table? I take a particular interest in systems thinking, the benefit of thinking in a systems way where you are seeking the perspective of different expertise, you're more likely to get a better result in the end.
So Steve, Pam, that's been a really fantastic discussion. Thank you very much. Hugely interesting. And I've definitely learned something, particularly Steve's model with hands. And as I say, I'm going to be wandering around town now trying to think about all the different factors which are involved in inclusive design. Let's hope inclusive design becomes the default for infrastructure as we move forward. Thank you again to our guests today, Steve Maslin from Atkins Reardis and Pam Turton from Bath and North East Somerset Council. And thank you, of course, for listening.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.